Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3107. United States of America versus Peter R. Turner, appellant. Mr. Luke for the appellant, Mr. Sullivan for the appellee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Arthur Luke on behalf of Peter Turner. I'm joined at council table by Michelle Woods. Peter Turner was wrongly convicted on the basis of insufficient evidence, then improperly sentenced in several respects. I would like to begin by briefly addressing the insufficiency claim, then turn to the sentencing issues. We acknowledge that a panel of this court affirmed Mr. Turner's co-defendant's convictions in the Andrews case. But because Andrews conceded Mr. Turner's guilt and Mr. Turner does not, that panel did not reach Mr. Turner's claim. Furthermore, we respectfully submit that Andrews was wrongly decided. The four pieces of evidence cited in Andrews as dispositive are insufficient, as we explain in our briefs. The principle established in this court's Taffer decision, that where the government's evidence of guilt is thin, alternative hypotheses of innocence become sufficiently strong to instill a reasonable doubt, applies here, and Mr. Turner's conviction should be overturned. Turning now to the sentencing issues, there is no dispute that Mr. Turner was improperly sentenced under the wrong base offense level. At a minimum, a remand is required. The district court also used the wrong addition of the sentencing guidelines. Under the Supreme Court's Grunewald decision, subsequent acts of concealment done after the central objectives of a conspiracy have been attained do not extend the conspiracy. And here the indictment alleges a conspiracy whose main goals and whose central objectives, the focus under Grunewald, were fraudulently obtaining insurance benefits and paying bribes. Those objectives were completed by February 2001.
Well, what about the part of Grunewald also? You're right, Grunewald rejected the subsidiary conspiracy theory because of a lack of evidence, but it spent a page or two in the case describing the other theory, that is, the theory that the government could have proceeded on a continuing conspiracy theory because there were overacts to support it. The indictment in that case said they charged an indictment to defraud the U.S. in the exercise of its governmental functions of administering the Internal Revenue Code and of detecting and prosecuting violations, right? That was the indictment. And then there were several overt acts in support of that. And the court said, that would have been okay, but there was no evidence that the government in that case had proceeded on that theory. And that's just like this case, isn't it?
It's distinguishable for several reasons. Yeah. First is the IRS case is different because the IRS had a continuing obligation to audit tax returns. There was an independent government
function. Well, isn't that true here? Isn't there the OPM had an oversight responsibility and a responsibility to investigate cases like this and to recover fraudulent obtained funds?
The testimony is a little bit different. Anthony Plessy, the claims administrator, testified that the OPM program, the OFEGLI program, does not look behind the designation of beneficiary form. And what happened here is it was presented to them, they processed it, the money was paid out, and it was received by Mr. Turner and paid to his co-defendant. There was no independent obligation to look into that and audit it as you would an IRS case. In fact, he testified quite the opposite, that because of administrative constraints.
Well, the IRS doesn't audit all tax returns.
But there's a substantial risk of that. The Dietz case, I believe it's D-I-E-Z, cited in the Andrews opinion, makes that clear, where there's a substantial risk that there will be some audit, some government investigation. Then yes, you may have a continuing conspiracy to conceal. But that's contradicted by the testimony in this case.
But there's nothing in either this case or Foreman. There's nothing in Grunwald or Foreman which suggests that that was a material consideration to the court, is there?
I'm not aware that there is, but yeah. I believe analytically it should be.
Uh-huh.
And that's because the economic benefits of this conspiracy were obtained, whereas in the tax evasion cases, they were not. In the tax evasion cases, the defendants held the money,
right.
And they were waiting until the government would process their returns, but they were never required to pay that to the government. The flow of funds is different here, where the government affirmatively paid to the co-defendants the money, and they had the benefits of their conspiracy in hand.
Uh-huh.
If I may proceed,
yeah.
As you mentioned, the conspiracy in Grunwald is actually quite strikingly similar to the conspiracy charged here.
Right.
There again, it was to defraud the United States in the exercise of governmental functions, and that allegation in and of itself is insufficient to sustain.
But the indictment here charges the defendant with defrauding the U.S. by impeding the lawful functions and duties of OPM. That's just like the charge with respect to the IRS in Foreman.
But that alone was also similar to what was charged in Grunwald and held
same
not sufficient.
Right, but the court in Grunwald said that that the government could have proceeded on that theory. It just there was no evidence that it had.
That's correct.
Right. So I guess what I'm asking is how can we I'm as concerned about the breadth of the government's argument here that you are. I see your concern about its potential for eviscerating statutes of limitation. But given these two Supreme Court cases, isn't this exactly the kind of case that those two decisions hold are permissible theories of conspiracy?
I don't think so. Grunwald talks about looking at...
Remember, all the judge asked you was whether they were permissible theories
right.
of prosecution.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. I see your point. I would simply observe in addition to that that Grunwald does instruct us to look at the main goals and central objectives of an indictment in assessing what the scope of the charged conspiracy is. And if you do that, you see that the charged conspiracy really consists of obtaining the benefits and paying the bribes in February 2001.
Uh-huh.
I should note also that the Ofegli program paid out the additional benefits to the Mayo family in 2005. The charged acts of concealment occurred after that point. In other words, it was properly determined who the beneficiary should be, and the benefits were properly distributed. By the time of the acts of concealment, the government was only investigating for the purposes of a criminal prosecution. It was no longer just for the purposes of administrating the benefits.
What do you take of the language about direct evidence of a separate agreement?
That was my next point, Your Honor. There has to be direct evidence. I believe it's in the pyramid case of this circuit that there must be some direct evidence that the conspirators plotted at the inception of their conspiracy to indefinitely conceal their activities. There is no evidence of that in this case. And that is yet another basis in which to conclude the conspiracy, even if it was adequately proven at trial, which again, we do not concede, that the conspiracy ended by its own terms in February 2001. I'd also like to raise another point on this issue, and that is whether the advisory guidelines after Booker eliminate any ex post facto concerns. They do not. This circuit's decision in Fletcher, applying the Supreme Court's Garner versus Jones decision, makes clear that the exercise of discretion is not dispositive. The issue is whether there is a significant risk that retroactive application will result in a longer period of incarceration than under the earlier rule. This may be proven in two ways: facial distinctions between the new and the old laws, and practical effect.
Does it matter? Why does it matter? If the district judge used an incorrect guideline, should have applied the other one, and then the earlier one, because the conspiracy had in fact ended, then why does it matter whether it's ex post facto or not?
It would affect the advisory guideline range. And may I point to the court to District Judge Bates' opinion in United States versus Restrepo Suarez. That's 516 Federal Supplement 2nd, 112.
No. It's clear we don't have an ex post facto problem if the district judge pulls the wrong guideline out and sentences somebody pursuant to it, right? It's not an ex post facto problem, it's just a mistake of law.
Correct.
Right, all right. The law was that the guideline in effect at the time of sentencing should apply unless it would result in a higher range.
Right.
Okay. And that was the law, one way or the other. And so if he and the judge was going to follow that, he intended to follow it. His judgment was that the guideline in effect at the time of sentencing was the 2006. If
Correct.
We say that, no, that was not the one that you should have followed because of the conspiracy had ended, then call it ex post facto or not, but it doesn't matter. It seems to me we send it back for a reevaluation. If the judge wants to treat the new guideline as giving that some weight, then that's a different issue. That's the issue that Judge Posner talked about in his opinion in this area.
Right. I bring the court's attention to the Restrepo Suarez case because Judge Bates explains his sentencing process. He begins by looking at what the applicable guideline should be. And in this case, if you use the 2000 guideline, you have a lower base offense level, of 10 versus 12. And that is where you begin the sentencing process.
Right.
And from there, you go through the other processes. You may decide to downward depart, you may decide to vary, but you have to start with the correct sentence.
Don't the guidelines themselves say use the guidelines in effect unless it would result in a higher sentence?
Absolutely.
That's my only point. That's a legal requirement. It may stem from worries about the ex post facto clause that aren't really as severe now as they were before Booker, but nevertheless, that's part of the law. So.
Right.
Okay.
Let me just take you back to the distinction you see between Grunewald and Foreman on the one hand and this case on the other. Do I understand your argument is that it turns on the nature of the IRS's responsibilities as compared to OPM? Is that the difference between the two cases?
It certainly informs our decision as to whether the acts of concealment were in furtherance of the main objectives of the conspiracy or not. Where the objective is tax evasion, then certainly evading the IRS's regulatory scrutiny is something that must be considered an act of concealment. But when there is no likelihood of regulatory oversight, then that is not essential or in furtherance of the main objective.
Okay, so the difference then is, let me see if I can say it then, the difference is that it's more likely that the IRS will audit a tax return than it is that OPM would have investigated this theft, this fraud?
Your Honor.
But wouldn't OPM investigate? Your point is that they, so you're saying that OPM isn't auditing these forms, that these insurance forms, right?
Correct. They review them at the initial inception. Right. They determine whether it's valid or not.
Right.
They pay it, and that's it. That was the testimony.
And the IRS?
They look at a tax return, but they may decide to audit it subsequently. There is additional regulatory oversight.
Uh-huh.
And so in this case, if the objective was to defraud, that fraud was completed in 2001 when the monies were paid out. The tax evasion.
Okay, so it seems to me you'd have a good case if OPM had never investigated it. You know, there was no active investigation until too late.
Right.
But here you have a case where there's an active investigation by OPM and an allegation that the defendants interfered with it.
The investigation was brought on by the decedent's mother, Lorenza Mayo.
Correct.
She complained. The form got processed anyway. She then instigated a civil suit in the District of Maryland against the Fegley program.
Right.
And that is what triggered this investigation.
No, I understand that. But my point was is that given the fact that there was an active investigation here, isn't it then parallel to the tax cases?
I don't think so. I believe the active investigation is not the function, is not.
It's the legal responsibility that you see as the distinction. That is the fact that the IRS actively audits returns and OPM only investigates cases when allegations of fraud are brought to its attention.
I don't want to misstate the legal responsibilities. I do believe the OPM's legal responsibilities do include investigating them. What the distinction I'm drawing is a practical one. The testimony in this case was that the OPM does not do that as a matter of practice.
Okay, and why would that make a difference? Why would that distinguish this case from Foreman and Grunewald?
There's no risk in the OPM case of the government investigating on its own and the need to continue to conceal.
So you can assume from the, in the tax case then, your point is that you can assume from the original conspiracy, right, that they must have intended to continue the conspiracy afterwards because of the continuing responsibility of the IRS.
Yes,
is that your point?
Yes, it's inherent in the nature of the definition of the tax evasion offense. Evasion is an affirmative element.
Do you know of any case that's made this distinction?
I do not.
Yeah, me neither. Mm.
I see that my time is up, okay. And if I may, I'll reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. Mr. Turner raises a number of issues on appeal, including a sufficiency of the evidence argument. As was pointed out during appellant's argument, his co-defendant, Ms. Andrews, raised a similar argument in her appeal. That argument was rejected. It's very similar to the one that Mr. Turner is now raising. And we believe the same result should be had here. As the court knows, it is a narrow standard of review. He argues two specific points, that there was insufficient evidence that he had engaged in forgery and fraud. I'd be happy to go through the evidence below to explain how there was more than ample evidence on that particular point. He also claims that there was insufficient evidence that LaTanya Andrews had agreed to engage in a scheme to defraud and that she had received a $1,000 bribe. Again, that was the exact same issue that was raised by Ms. Turner that was rejected by a panel of this court. Turning to the ex post facto clause argument, Mr. Turner argues that the clause was violated when the district court applied the 2006 edition of the sentencing guideline manual instead of the 2001 version. Mr. Turner is incorrect on this particular point for two separate reasons. First, the court correctly used the 2006 edition of the sentencing guidelines because the conspiracy specifically alleged in the indictment and the conspiracy that was specifically proven at trial was one that began in December of 2000 and continued all the way up through January of 2006.
So would the argument be that any time a defendant is indicted for stealing money from the government or in connection with a government program, he is necessarily on notice that the indictment extends to any subsequent investigation into whether there was any criminal activity on his part?
Your Honor,
I'm thinking of grant programs, loans, all those types of interactions that citizens have with the federal government.
Your Honor raises an interesting point. I don't know if it can be stated that broadly, but certainly in this particular situation where Mr. Turner and Ms. Andrews engaged in a scheme with others the purpose of which was to commit a deceit on OPM and the Fegley program, that they were on notice that at some point in time...
But that's the point of Judge Rogers' question. You can describe any fraud against the government that way.
Any effort,
any stealing of money or property from the government.
Certainly, and that's
can be described that way. And every government agency has a unit within it that investigates fraud.
That's correct, Your Honor. The difference here, though, is that the indictment specifically alleged a conspiracy that was broader than simply a crime of stealing money and committing forgery. It was broader than that, alleged in the indictment. They were on notice.
It's up to the prosecutor when he hands the indictment over to the grand jury. I mean, if the investigation didn't occur until 20 years after this event, you would say that the statute of limitations hadn't run.
No, Your Honor, we wouldn't. Each individual...
Why? The investigation starts, and Ms. Andrews denies having received any money in the form of a check or otherwise from the defendant in this case, and then she's confronted with this old check, and she says it's a loan, and you know, all the rest of it. The only thing that's different is the investigation took occurred a long time later. That's all. That shouldn't matter.
Your Honor, the thing to take into consideration here is that this investigation did begin fairly soon after the forgery and the payment of the cash to Ms. Andrews, but...
That can't be the legal test, though.
No, Your Honor, we're not suggesting that it is. The legal test is articulated in Grunewald and Foreman, and what Foreman makes clear is that when a central objective of the underlying conspiracy involves concealment, as it does here and as it was alleged and proven at trial, that takes it out of the Grunewald general rule.
I think that's a much too broad formulation. Number one, conspiracies are, by their nature and by definition, secret. Would you name one conspiracy where a central objective was not to get caught?
Certainly, and that point was made in Grunewald, Your Honor.
Right.
But there is...
That's all you're doing is reformulating a rejected rationale, it seems to me. I mean, you're reformulating a rationale that Grunewald rejected.
Respectfully, we disagree. We're not trying to regurgitate a rejected formula here. We're actually indicating, as it was alleged in the indictment and, again, as proven at trial, that the underlying conspiracy was one where a central objective was to not just commit deceit on the OPM, but also to frustrate their purpose.
But see, you can make that charge in any case involving fraud or deceit against the government, or for that matter, any major institution. So as a practical matter, you've eviscerated the statute of limitations by drafting the indictment that way. Because you can do it in every case. Anybody who steals from the government or a major institution, you can charge them with a conspiracy to conceal the results of it and frustrate the investigation.
And that was the concern articulated in Grunewald. First, let's just be clear here that this was not a statute of limitations concern. This is a sentencing guidelines issue concern.
Right.
But with that distinction in mind...
I don't think that matters. Do you? Because the question in this case and the question in Grunewald and the other statute of limitations cases, when did the conspiracy end?
Right.
So the fact that one is a guideline case and the other is a statute of limitations doesn't matter because the question is the same, unless you're proposing some different test.
I'm not proposing a different test. I think each case has to be determined on its individual facts and circumstances.
That's
though.
True of every... Do you know a case where that's not true?
I do not, and yes, it is a common sense point. But the point that I am trying to articulate, though, is I brought up that this was not a statute of limitations situation because, in theory, what we could have done, because this was charged in January of 2006, in theory, we could have brought this in January of 2011, and that's where I think there might have been a concern had 10 years after the underlying acts, this issue had been brought and charged as it was. The distinction here is it was brought within the statute of limitations time frame. It clearly articulated in very definite terms in the indictment that one of the objects was to frustrate OPM and Fegley in carrying out their duties. This was a situation
Suppose the facts were that they were exactly the same as in this case. OPM was doing an investigation, except that the defendant had put the money under his bed, and there was no lying to the investigator, and no threat to what's that guy's name? LeBron. Yeah. Just put the money under his bed.
Well, then certainly that's a different factual situation.
But wouldn't it be the same in your theory? Your theory, he put the money under the bed. They put the money under his bed because they didn't want the OPM to find it.
Well, in that sense, it's actually consistent with what we're arguing.
Yeah, that's my point.
And that's exactly the example. For instance, in Grunewald, they talk about the kidnapping example where the distinction between a ongoing continuing conspiracy as opposed to a separate conspiracy to conceal is one analogous to a kidnapping situation, where the latter situation, where it's just a conspiracy to conceal, is where they abandon the kidnapped person and try to conceal that they or cover up the crime. The difference here, and what is similar to the hypothetical that you posed, Mr. Turner, Ms. Andrews, didn't want to disgorge the benefits that they actually received. So from the get-go, the intent of the conspiracy was not only to commit a deceit and a fraud.
Yeah, right. I understand that, but you see, the questions all three of us are asking you are trying to get at what are the limits of this theory that you're offering here? Because it seems to be unlimited. Even in the hypothetical I gave you with the money under the bed, you seem to think that this theory would work.
And Your Honor, it has been articulated that the Grunewald Foreman distinctions are tough decisions.
Yeah, what we're looking at is the question is, right, what can you reasonably imply from the original conspiracy, correct?
That's correct.
That's the question. Well, what do you think about defense counsel's suggestion that, sure, in the IRS situation where the IRS has a continuing responsibility to audit, you can reasonably imply there that the conspiracy must have included disrupting the IRS's investigation, because everybody knows the IRS has an obligation to audit. Whereas here, this is not an audit agency. This is they pay these things and they only investigate if someone makes a charge. So there's no reason why the original conspirators, you could imply that they also conspired to interrupt the federal agency's efforts to discover the crime.
Respectfully to appellant counsel, I think it's a distinction without a difference. Uh-huh. This is the exact same situation as those IRS cases. It's the same situation as the Mann decision out of the Fifth Circuit dealing with the Federal Home Loan Bank Board.
Well, but stick with Foreman and Grunewald. You agree, there is a difference between the responsibilities of the agencies, right? OPM doesn't have the same audit responsibility that the IRS does. You agree with that?
I would agree with that. Yeah. But what I would also submit is that OPM, it is well known that OPM has an obligation to determine whether they have paid a correct beneficiary death benefits on a life insurance policy. So I think it is fair to say that Mr. Turner and Ms. Andrews were on notice that when they engaged in this scheme to defraud, that there was an understanding at the time that OPM, if it was discovered, if it received an allegation that the underlying scheme of deceit had been uncovered, that they would take additional steps to not just protect themselves, but to cover up the underlying crime. The two are part and parcel of the same.
Remind me, what is the difference in the guideline range between your position and the defendant's position?
It would be if appellant's argument were accepted, the base offense would have been a 10 using the 2001 guidelines. Here, Mr. Turner was sentenced using a base offense of 14. We conceded in our briefs, though, that using 14 was incorrect under the 2006 guidelines. It should have been 12. So there's a two-point difference.
2 points. Okay. I want to ask you about this obstruction bump. Now, I've often wondered, you're a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Do you try cases?
I do.
Do you ever call witnesses into your office? Question?
Not in my office, usually in a conference room, yes.
In a conference room,
sure.
Right? And you sit around, and sometimes you've had the experience that I think all prosecutors have, where you've said, in the presence of the witness's counsel, you know, you're in deep trouble. You're facing a 20-year charge. We can put you away. But if you cooperate, that's the word usually used, that, you know, we're going to take that into account. And by cooperation, it's clear to the witness, it means testify in favor of the government. Is that obstruction of justice?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
In that we ask an individual to cooperate against others in continuing our investigation.
Does that put coercion on the witness? Is that coercive?
Not the way you described it in your hypothetical. It's not.
It's not?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
Well, listen, I've been defense counsel in situations like that, and it's darn coercive. And you walk out, and the witness is shaking, and they see their life slipping away. But be that as it may, the first conversation that is cited by you as obstruction of justice is the defendant saying, I didn't do this. These people are out to get me, and I didn't do anything wrong. Now, why is that evidence of obstruction of justice?
Well, I think, first off, you need to keep the two conversations both in mind. But let's focus on the first one in August of 2003. At the point in time that Mr. Turner approached Mr. LeBron, he initiates the contact. He initiates it in the hallway outside Mr. LeBron's office.
Yeah, it's like you calling a witness's attorney up and saying, initiating the conversation, come on down here to our conference room. We want to chat with you.
I think, respectfully, there is a difference when a prosecutor is talking to defense counsel or a pro se witness. But when two witnesses are contacting each other, the key thing to keep in mind here is that Mr. Turner approaches Mr. LeBron knowing that LeBron is a key central witness to the investigation, knowing that Mr. LeBron has talked to the agents, and knowing that he is the only individual at that point in time who is not a member of the conspiracy, who is still alive, who could point the finger at the form and say, my name was forged on that. Mm-hmm. So I think that is persuasion, that is coercion on the part of Mr. Turner to approach him in that regard, and looking at the commentary, the comment under 3C1.1 is quite broad. What he was attempting to do was persuade.
That incident, and I grant you there's ambiguity in the second one is different, but the first one, I can't for the life of me see where the government has a monopoly in being able to talk to witnesses, but the defendant doesn't. If the defendant talks to a witness and says, I'm innocent, then the government comes back in a brief in this court and says that's obstruction of justice. If the government talks to the witness and says the guy's guilty, that's not. I don't get it. Why don't you go into the second encounter? This is the one that LeBron couldn't remember at trial, right?
That's correct. And if I may respond, yeah. I'm out of time.
But yeah, oh, yeah, go ahead.
First off, there is a difference with the government has ethical obligations as to how we can approach witnesses, who we can go through in contacting witnesses. It's a much different situation when you have individual witnesses trying to contact individuals and to persuade, threaten, intimidate. There has to be some sort of guideline in that regard. But going to the second contact, in January 2006, Mr. Turner makes clear, he again initiates a contact with Mr. LeBron, wherein, at this point in time...
How did that occur? I thought it was a chance encounter. Weren't they leaving the building or something? They ran into each other?
The testimony was that they were both in the VA Medical Center, so it may have been a chance encounter in that regard. But again, the point is...
So we can disregard the initiates the contact, because that sounds like he called him up and went over to his house or something.
Well, the point I was trying to make is that... they're not best friends either. So Mr. Turner is coming up to an individual who, by and large, is a stranger, and in that regard, telling him that the investigators don't know I have PT, post-traumatic stress disorder. I may go home and get my gun.
But you left out the qualifier in the middle of that sentence, didn't you? If this had been
In the old days.
If this had been in the old days.
Well, then there's a clause in there, so it's unclear whether he's talking about the old days. And admittedly, there is some ambiguity
statement. I agree with you. There's ambiguity,
But I think it's fair that a reasonable person could have interpreted that as threatening. And that's a key.
Was Mr. LeBron a reasonable person?
Mr. LeBron was a reasonable person, but I don't think
he interpreted it as not threatening.
The way to view this issue is not from the perspective of Mr. LeBron as to whether he felt intimidated or not. The question is, was there an attempt? It's the intent of Mr. Turner.
I agree with you. It seems like the district judge followed what you're saying, that he just interpreted it in an objective way. And that seems to me to be incorrect. And the reason it seems to me to be, I think you have to interpret it from the point of view of Mr. LeBron. And the reason I think that is because so much in an ambiguous statement like this turns on the inflection of the voice, on the how threatening the encounter was in terms of physical presence, on the gesticulation by the individual, on whether the person was kind of smiling and laughing, none of which we know. We don't know anything about that. The only thing we do know is the words, which he couldn't remember, but this is about what it was. And then the other thing we know is that he said, I didn't consider this to be a threat to me.
And again,
And yet he gets a two-bump obstruction.
Last response on that, then, is, first off, it's a deferential abuse of discretion standard, and the appellate court, even though it may have viewed that had it been the sentencing judge would have come out a different way, that's not enough to reverse on that particular point. Again, we would reiterate the way to view this, though, is the intent.
Is this abuse of discretion, or is this a question of whether there was a preponderance of evidence to support the finding of the district court that he engaged in obstruction of justice?
The standard that should be applied by this court is abuse of discretion if we're applying Gall, Rita, and Kimbrough. Mm.
But if the judge applied the wrong legal standard, I thought that was the thrust of Judge Randolph's comment.
Right.
Then that would be an abuse of discretion.
If the judge had, and we submit that the judge did not, in fact gave a very thoughtful, reasoned discussion on this and acknowledged that both sides of the argument and came out with a decision that we do believe was not an abuse.
I want to ask you two other questions about the conspiracy question and had a distinguished foreman in the other tax case. But let me just ask you this. Suppose, would this fall into your theory of a continuing conspiracy? Two guys rob a bank, and over the next 10 to 15 years, from time to time, they dig up the money and put it somewhere else to protect it from being discovered. And they're indicted for conspiracy to rob a bank and, quote, impairing, impeding, and defeating the lawful functions of the Metropolitan Police Department. Now, would that be okay? Would that continue? There would be no statute of limitations problem there because of the conspiracy?
Your Honor, in your hypothetical, the answer is no.
Why?
I think that would be a problem in that particular situation.
What's the difference?
One difference is that robbery would not involve a scheme to defraud. I mean, the difference here is that the underlying crime committed is one of deceit and fraud, of which is based on concealment. From the get-go,
most respectable bank robbers, I suspect, want to conceal and hide the money, don't they?
Certainly. It's true of all crimes that they don't want to get caught. But like the tax line of cases, we have a situation here. The second distinction is you indicated that the indictment would allege that it's trying to frustrate or impede, impair.
I just quoted quoted the language from the indictment here.
Yes,
that's where I got that language.
Yes, Your Honor, and you applied it to the Metropolitan Police Department rather than the bank. And I think that is a distinction here. What, Mr. Turner, Mrs. Andrews?
Well, then change the hypothetical that way. By impairing and defeating the investigative functions of the bank.
And I would say in that particular situation that there's probably no understanding on the part of the defendants in your hypothetical that there's this ongoing obligation of the bank. I think there is a difference with a regulated...
Well, then what about the Metropolitan Police Department? I mean, they all know that the police department is out there investigating crimes. That's why they're hiding their money.
Is there any difference based on the fact that in the tax cases, the charge is evasion of taxes as distinct from simply didn't pay a tax? And here, the parallel would be an indictment that charged a conspiracy to get this money and then the bribery charge and to impede any investigation that might lead to a criminal prosecution for these actions.
The indictment here is not stated that broadly.
But wouldn't that be a parallel to the tax cases where they're charging evasion?
When they charge evasion, there is typically language in the indictment similar to the one in this particular case, where you're trying to impede, impair, and defeat the lawful functions of the IRS. Just as in Mann, it was impeding, impairing, and defeating the lawful functions of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and just as here, it's impeding, impairing, and defeating the lawful functions of a regulated entity, OPM.
What would cause the statute of limitations to run in a tax evasion case?
In a tax evasion case?
I suppose if the tax evader got on national television and said, "I've evaded taxes," then the clock would start ticking. But short of that,
and that is discussed in the tax-related cases, is the further out you get from the filings that did not include the income that should have been reported, the more troubling it gets. But that's why I started with that common sense proposition that you have to look at each case individually.
Well, maybe Grunwald and Foreman are distinguishable because in the tax situation, the taxpayer, even if the taxpayer doesn't pay taxes in a particular year that they're due, that taxpayer still has a legal obligation to pay that tax up through and until the statute of limitations runs.
Correct.
That's not true here. He didn't have any legal obligation to return this money.
That's correct. That is a distinction.
Well, the other thing is that every year that you fail to pay, the penalties accumulate.
That's correct. That's a distinction, too.
So the penalties, whatever it is, if 5 years go by, it doesn't mean that the penalties are not running. The penalties continue and continue. It's penalties plus interest, isn't it?
Right.
Uh-huh. It is, yeah.
I mean, they're good answers, or they're answers to each of those, in terms of being law-abiding citizens, coming forth, et cetera. But it's just a question, as Judge Tatel says, of what's the limit to the government's theory?
And that's something that I know that the panel is wrestling with. I would submit on this regard.
You haven't shown us any limits. I haven't seen any yet. That's our problem.
Well, and I think the difference is...
Maybe your answer is that's okay. These are fraud against the government.
The answer is that you have to look at each case individually because the indictment is very explicit about what the conspiracy was decided on a special verdict by the jury wherein they determined that the Fegley program and OPM's functions were defeated and impaired. And where the evidence actually conformed to what that very detailed indictment alleged,
that's
the distinction.
But the district court is careful when she's talking about that. She says, well, it's a broad charge of fraud and interference. So it's not as though the jury was instructed that did the defendants fraudulently obtain the money as part of this conspiracy? And did they also, as part of the conspiracy, enter into an agreement, impede any subsequent investigation? So it's not as though the jury had those questions clearly posed as distinct questions.
They did have a special verdict form which did lay out the specific objects which they had to check off. They did right. receive the indictment.
But I looked at the verdict form, and it doesn't make that distinction.
My understanding is that they had to go through and actually check off which of the objects of the conspiracy had been met.
Right, but just as it's alleged in the indictment in this broad sense of mm-hmm. interfering. And they interfered when they initially got the money through these fraudulent means. Now the question is, was there something more involved? That would have been the core purpose of the conspiracy.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
Okay, well, Mr. Sullivan was up 13 extra minutes, so I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'll try not to use all two. I do have the verdict form here, and it does not allege a broad conspiracy. It simply says to defraud the United States, guilty or not guilty. And I'd like to make two brief points on the obstruction front. First is the standard. It must be willful. And that is to say, Mr. Turner must have acted with the purpose of obstructing justice. Your Honor has recognized the ambiguity. I don't think you can find that on the record.
Well, it's also attempted obstruction.
Yes, Your Honor, and you have to find an attempt from all the circumstances. Appellee's counsel conceded that Mr. LeBron was a reasonable person. So even under an objective standard for an attempt, we've conceded that the reasonable person did not feel threatened.
I don't know that he conceded that.
Fair enough. I may have been saying a little bit too much. But if we view Mr. LeBron as a reasonable person, we have to consider his three efforts to explain to the district court that this was not an attempt to obstruct justice. We have to look at his immediate reaction to the second conversation. How did he react immediately in the moment? I looked at him and I said, what? And I said, you know, take it easy. Have a good day, a good weekend, or something like that. He did not in the moment view this as an attempt to obstruct justice in any way. I should also mention that the second conversation.
Didn't he leave something out? Didn't he also say, he said, calm down or something?
I don't have that in front of me. I'm happy to reference it, but.
Do you remember the page? I just want to nail
it. It's on page 377. Line 18, question.
Oh, yeah, here it is. It's on page 62, 377. I looked at him and said, what? And I said, you know, take it easy.
I believe that's how I'd read it.
If I'd slurred
my words. But,
okay.
But the one thing I would note also about the two conversations is the span of time in between them. It's 2.5 years later that the second conversation occurs. Mr. Turner clearly knows after the first conversation that Mr. LeBron is a witness. If he wanted to obstruct justice, would he have waited 2.5 years to make their next contact, particularly because he was a constant visitor at the VA hospital? That, I submit, does not make sense.
Is your point that whatever LeBron had to give the government, he had already given it to him?
It could have been very well, and Mr. Turner didn't know that. If he wanted to influence Mr. LeBron, he would have done it much closer in time to the initial meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Luck, you and your co-counsel, Ms. Woods, were appointed by the court, and we appreciate your assistance. Thank you.
Thank you.